Nadine Gordimer is one of South Africa's best-known writers. She's a longtime opponent of her country's racist policies and has written about the agonies of apartheid in her novels and short stories. In July's People, she imagined life during civil war. In A Sport of Nature, she projected a vision of black majority rule. Gordimer is a vice president of PEN, the International Writers Organization. Her new book, The Essential Gesture, is a collection of essays written between the early 1950s and 1985. Many of these pieces are about what it means to be a writer in South Africa and where, as a white woman, she sees herself fitting into the fight against apartheid. Gordimer told me that she's still shaken up by the assassination a couple of weeks ago of David Webster, a professor who worked with and studied the anti-apartheid movement. I asked Gordimer why she thinks he was gunned down.
Well, he was a social anthropologist teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand, but he was very much concerned with the fate of detainees, people who are arrested, taken into prison, and not charged. These are political offenders, so-called, and they are often kept for weeks, months, years before they're charged or they are released. Most recently, there was a big countrywide hunger strike mounted by these detainees, because many of them had been in so long and couldn't get themselves released and were not charged. They didn't know what they were there for, just simply held. So that would be one reason, his involvement with publicizing the hunger strike. He also did a lot of writing on civil rights issues and political issues and spoke in public on them. And he was in the process of writing, I think it was going to be a small book, about the methods used to suppress opposition in South Africa, opposition against apartheid. And he'd examined all the different things that are used by the state, banning people, restricting their movements, detaining them, and so on. And he'd come to the conclusion that nothing really stopped people who were determined to oppose apartheid, except right-wing terrorism in the form of assassination. And he was writing this on the Friday, and on the 1st of May, May Day, public holiday in South Africa, he was shot dead from a passing car outside his own house.
Do you think that this is a paradox, or do you think that the assassins knew the conclusions he was arriving at in his research?
Oh, I think they did, because he had been publishing bits and pieces of it here and there.
I see.
And maybe they felt that something about them and their methods that would lead to their being brought to justice was going to come out in this.
Well, his theory was that the only effective intimidation was assassination. Now that another friend of yours has been assassinated, what effect does it have on you and on your courage?
Well, it has an effect on all of us. And indeed, he was the one who pinpointed it, that when somebody is simply shot down by unknown assailants like that, it's not a risk that you know you're taking. You know that you risk being detained. You know that you risk losing your passport. But you don't think about being shot down outside your own house. And it certainly is something that sent a ripple of fear through activists against apartheid. But people still find the courage, just as he did always, to go on. He had the most enormous funeral, with tremendous support from blacks who filled the streets outside the cathedral where the service was held. He was greatly loved by people of all colours and had a tremendous following among black people. So he was a living proof of the non-racial nature of the struggle against injustice in South Africa.
Are funerals like that legal now?
Well, no, not. They very often are stopped, but I think the government was so embarrassed over this assassination, whether they were involved, whether the police were involved with it or not, that probably for the sake of world opinion, they didn't feel they could ban that funeral, and it turned into an enormous political anti-apartheid demonstration. They were there with the police and dogs, and I've never seen such an enormous police presence, but there was no violence. Nothing happened. It passed off peacefully.
Are you in need of causes for optimism in order to continue the work that you're doing?
Well, I think there are causes for optimism. Even in the tragic instance of the incident I've just told you about, when you see black and white people coming together in the mass out of respect and love for a man like David Webster, you feel optimism vis-à-vis the fears that people express to me here in America and outside, that whites, there'll be no place for whites in South Africa when we have black majority rule. I don't believe this, and I keep seeing evidence that it is not so. It depends upon whites. It depends how they behave. It depends which side they show they're on now, not just out of their mouths, but out of their actions as well.
Nadine Gordimer is my guest. I'm curious about when you became aware of apartheid. You grew up in South Africa. Your parents were emigres, your mother from London, your father, I think, from Lithuania. You grew up in a mining town. When did you become aware of apartheid?
Well, I think I was quite a late developer, really, when I consider the awareness, political awareness of my own children a generation later. But in that small town, you know how it is, particularly in a small town where you're not open to many other mind-blowing influences, you tend to adopt the attitudes and the mores of your parents and your teachers and so on. And I just took it as natural as a child that I went to a segregated school, I went to a convent school, all the kids were white, and that the only people, only blacks that I was in touch with were people doing the menial jobs, sweeping the streets, acting as servants, messengers, and so on. I mean, they were all around, and of course, as it was a mining town, there were thousands of black migratory miners who lived in their compounds, as we call them, barracks, quite near where we lived, but were completely separate from us, not only by language, but they just had no part in our lives. But when I was about, I was a great reader, and I really came to think about apartheid in terms of class injustice from reading people like Upton Sinclair when I was a teenager. And then I began to look around me, and I began to write very young, and by the time I was 17, I think the first published story that I wrote was indeed about apartheid, not in a formula form, but as it affected the lives of the people that I knew. It was about a police raid on a house for illicit liquor brewing by the black servant.
Was opposing apartheid, did that also mean that you had to oppose your parents? Did your parents support the system?
Well, my father, I think, did. You must remember that when I was a child, the word apartheid hadn't even been coined. And the apartheid government only came into power in 1948 when I was grown up. I'm talking about the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was a sort of colonial racism with quite a lot of paternalism mixed up in it. My mother had a social conscience, and she did good works, and I don't say that sneeringly. She was one of the people who helped form a creche and clinic for black children in the nearby black ghetto, which we called township then. And she was always uneasy and angry if she saw black people being treated badly. But it was always as a form of charity. She didn't connect it with the law. She didn't connect it with the fact that they didn't have rights as white people had.
Was writing for you a response to injustice, or do you think you would have become a writer one way or another?
Writing was not a response to injustice. I wasn't even aware of injustice. I began to write out of a sense of wonder at life, and also out of the mystery of life, wanting to find out what it was all about. It was my way of exploring life. And I think this is true of all artists. That's at the base of what we do. I don't think that any real artist begins from a political stimulation or conscience.
In the 1950s, you became friends with many black writers. Were there many obstacles at that time to developing friendships between black and white writers?
Yes, there were. But I think, as everywhere in the world, probably in the United States as well, writers and artists, actors, journalists have tended to be people who don't really fit in to a conventional pattern of life. and have more in common with one another and with the things that interest and absorb them, which cross colour, race, language, everything. And I think that this was true in South Africa as well. I had so much more in common with some young black person who was beginning to write than I had with the people in that mining town. So it was community of interest.
Did the people in your mining town see you as a traitor?
Well, I left there when I was quite young, and I don't know how they saw me. And while I was there and was quietly writing, it was very much a sort of secret activity. Nobody was particularly interested in it, which I think was a good thing for me. It left me to develop in my own way. I think they were a bit annoyed when my first book was published. My mother was still living there because it was set in a town like that, and first books are usually have quite a strong autobiographical element. So I think there was a bit of name spotting, you know, this is so-and-so and that's based on whatnot and tut-tut-tut, how could she do this?
Right. Nadine Gordimer is my guest, and she has a new collection of essays called The Essential Gesture. In one of your essays from 1959, you ask the question, where do whites fit in the new Africa? Nowhere, I'm inclined to say. What was the vision of the new Africa in the late 1950s?
Well, it was exciting, and it was strange that down in the south there, in the big toe of the continent, it seemed hardly to affect us at all. And this was partly due to lack of communication. It's always been much easier. Whites in South Africa have always been very Eurocentric. And indeed, when I was a young girl and a beginning writer, it was a dream of everybody then to go to London or to go to Paris. How could you possibly be a writer sitting, you know, in Johannesburg? Fortunately, I didn't ever have the money to go, and I think it was very fortunate because why become an expatriate for no reason and lose your background and your home? I'm a bit worried about that essay because many people don't notice that, as you did, that it was dated 59. It's a very long time ago. I didn't alter any of my opinions or bring them up to date in that book because I thought a personal book like this shows the development of one's opinions and one's responses to one's time in society. But I obviously, in 1959, doubted whether there would be a place for whites to continue to live in Africa. But so far as South Africa is concerned, I certainly don't believe that now. And I haven't believed it for many years. I'm quite sure that there is a place for whites, that the African National Congress, the Premier Liberation Movement has always been non-racial, still is. And it's simply a matter, it's not a simple matter for many whites, it's a matter of whites learning how to live in a different way, truly accepting what is coming, which is black majority rule, and not fearing, not wanting guarantees of group rights, which will set them aside, set them apart, mark them out forever. We've never had a Bill of Rights in South Africa. I think if the rights of the individual are guaranteed, what do you want to need to guarantee group rights for? You're only keeping the demarcation of colour and class there forever. I think whites certainly have a big part to play in the future free, non-racial South Africa, but they must learn to live differently. They can't be wanting to be the boss and ordering other people around and doing their thinking for them.
I've heard some whites in South Africa who've done liberal or radical work say that they fear, nevertheless, that if there is a revolution, there will be so much unleashed rage against white people, and understandably so, and this rage will not discriminate against white people who've been against apartheid and white people who've supported it, and on an individual basis, a lot of people won't know the difference. You know, people won't be wearing ID cards. Do you ever worry about that?
No, I must say I don't. I'm interested to hear that this should have come to you from people who have been active, because this is the kind of fear that comes from people who've never done anything with blacks.
Oh, I won't mention names here, but
no,
there's one
no.
person in particular who said that to me, who I'm thinking of.
Yes. I think it might have been true, it was true, in the 70s, during the black separatist time.
Mm-hmm.
But now with the United Democratic Front still operating under great difficulty, half banned, in the 80s there's been a great revival of democratic action across the colour line. And to return for a moment to the funeral of David Webster, the size of that funeral, the blacks and whites standing there, squashed together, shoulder and shoulder together, singing the same freedom songs, and the feeling of absolute unity of purpose and unity of sorrow. If you have that, you cannot feel that there is going to be great animosity against whites. There will be against some whites because they do terrible things and people will not forget. There are certain individuals who've done terrible things.
Was there a moment or a period where you stopped fluctuating between staying in South Africa or leaving and you just decided to stay?
Oh, there have really only been in my life one or two moments when I thought at all of leaving South Africa.
What were those moments?
Well, actually, they were in the 60s when, through personal circumstances, I could have gone to live in Zambia. And I went, I'd been travelling quite a bit in Central Africa generally, Tanzania, Kenya, Zambia. And I had what I realised later was a romantic idea that I could then commit myself to an African country as an African. Whereas in South Africa there was the struggle against white supremacists in the 60s, you must remember it was after Sharpeville, the African National Congress was banned, the other liberation movements were banned, and there was just a feeling of total stalemate that the apartheid government was going to be there forever. And I didn't want to spend my life as a white living in the white lager, struggling to keep contact with blacks. But I think fortunately for me, I discovered on visits to Zambia, much as I liked the country and the people, that there I was just regarded as a European. I was just a white person like people from expatriates from England working there or from any other country. Whereas at home, in my own country, there's never been a time when I felt I wasn't recognized as a white African.
Mm-hmm. Nadine Gordimer is the author of many collections of short stories as well as novels. Her books include A Sport of Nature, July's People, The Lying Days, and Something Out There. And I believe three of your books have been censored, is that right?
Three of my books have been banned over the years in South Africa. But lately, nothing of mine has been banned. And I optimistically hope that nothing will be. I think there's a certain protection in, I know there is, in becoming well-known outside. As I've become better known in the outside world, it has seemed hardly worthwhile for the government to ban a writer like myself, not a terribly easy writer to read, so that I think the calculation is that it's not worth the fuss that there is when a book of mine is banned, the fuss that there is in the outside world as well as at home. But in any case, censorship, the real clout of censorship has moved from the censorship banning of books to that of muzzling the press. The real heat is on the press, the media generally.
Mm-hmm. Is censorship almost a badge of honor? When your book has been censored, you know, knowing that the government was so outraged by it that they don't even want other people to read it.
Yes, I suppose so in a way, but really for me that's offset by the fact that it cannot be read by your own people then.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, now very few works of fiction are banned, and even quite tough non-fiction works. This is also because if they're on a certain level, they're not going to find a very large reading public. And you must remember there's complete control of television. It's all state television. People like myself don't write for television. We don't appear in discussion programs. We are muzzled in this way.
Well, while we're talking about press censorship, are there underground ways of information being spread that have developed in the light of press censorship?
Well, there are. There are indeed. But
none that you could talk about.
They are really quite dangerous.
Yeah.
And one of them we have just talked about, back to David Webster,
mm-hmm.
that he was one of the people engaged in bringing news from the detainees on hunger strike in the prisons. And as you can see, this is a dangerous thing to do.
Well, let me read to you a statement that you once said about writing. You said that the best way to write is to do so as if one were already dead, afraid of no one's reactions, answerable to no one's views. What led you to say that? And I guess I wonder if you've taken heat by, on both sides in South Africa.
No, this was just a conviction that goes really deeper than that. I think that a writer must always maintain the independence, the artistic independence, to use his or her insights, something that a writer has beyond the insights of other people, without worrying whether you're going to offend your mother, your best friend, or whether your political confreres are going to decide that you have let down the side. A writer must never let herself become a propagandist. Propagandists have a place, agitprop has a place, but I'm not that kind. I'm not that person. I'm a writer. I have a certain ability, and I feel the first duty is to use that ability properly. The nearest you can get to the truth, you get through using that ability properly, not worrying what anybody's going to say. That's why I would stand by that old statement, you know, that you must write as if you're already dead and not worry about the consequences. Because as soon as you've got your eye on an audience, on people who are watching you, are going to hear what you have to say, you're going to falsify that little extra vision you have that will bring you near to the truth. And in the end, if we look at your position, the writer's position in society, the essential gesture to society, in the end, it is what you're going to be able to record and discover of the truth that is going to serve your society best.
Do you feel that you've ever been expected to write books that would be more effective propaganda?
Oh, yes. Indeed.
Where has that pressure come from?
Well, it hasn't really been pressure. And it hasn't usually come from quarters that bothered me very much. Because I feel that if I took no part in community life and lived in an ivory tower, then perhaps I might listen to it. But I'm also a human being, a citizen, and I know that I have a certain responsibility toward my society for what's happened there, what's happened in my name as a white, whether I had anything to do with it or not. And so I have another part of my life which where I put my life on the line for what I believe in. And I think, therefore, I have the freedom to write as I feel I must, as I please. I'm not retiring into an ivory tower because I am doing other things as a human being and a citizen.
We talked a little earlier about how in the 1950s you became good friends with many black writers from South Africa. Is it any more difficult now to keep connections like that? What I mean is, do government restrictions make it really difficult to get together and to communicate?
No, only insofar as you know that when you're in organizations like our new writers' organization, of which I was one of the founders, it's only just going to be 2 years old in July. It's very young still. We know that we are watched because part of our preamble to our constitution is that we are committed to the liberation of South Africa. We are committed to working with and encouraging a grassroots culture, which means working with the cultural groups in trade unions. We make no excuses for it. We are a political organization because culture is political. We want to create a new culture. We know that we're watched when some of our members, not through directly through their activities with us, but through other activities, have been detained. They're quite closely questioned about us. So that there isn't anything in the that you do across the colour line without racial division, or even with racial division, if it's against the regime, that it doesn't bring you some kind of risk. But you can still mix as a writer with your black colleagues, if you wish, as long as you have what is really in common. First of all, the desire to do good work, and secondly, to understand your responsibility as a writer to other people who are struggling to learn to write, who have had fewer educational opportunities. And this applies to blacks as well as whites, because you have some of our writers, black writers, that teach in universities or run alternative education establishments. In other words, they're white-collar people. And there are lots and lots of people in the trade unions, among mine workers, peasants in the country, who long to write and to read. They don't have the libraries and they don't have the ability to express themselves. We feel it's part of our duty of being writers to work with them and help them.
It's interesting. You see it as a political responsibility.
Yes. It's a political and a professional and artistic responsibility.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a new organization of writers that you helped to found. What is it called?
It's called the Congress of South African Writers, COSOR. And it's really spreading out into the country. We try to get away from the concentration in the big cities with our readings and workshops. And we are about 95% black membership now. But by black, I mean we call black people that you call coloured, people who are of Indian descent, people who are of mixed blood and so on. But we have a 95% black membership.
One last question. What do you need to do to make sure that the organization doesn't get banned and get forced underground?
Well, we can't do anything because then we would be stifling our real convictions. We simply go on doing what we think is right and we're prepared to take the consequences.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.